We'll go ahead and start with introductions. I'm Mike Odrin with Olson Engineering.
Ali Safai, Development Engineering, Public Works.
Nicole Snyder, Community Development.
John Hardy, Butcher Raven.
Steve Bacon, Project and Wastewater.
Younger member, PLS Engineering.
Terry Wallen, Remax.
Eric Limo, SGA Engineering.
I'm Gaither, Gaither Pools.
Chuck Craig, Community Development.
Terry Allman, Community Planning.
Gordy Miller, Community Planning.
Carolina, is that correct?
That's the first building in the association.
Community Development.
Let the record show that that was Marty Snell.
Back there.
We're not wearing environmental services.
All right, thanks everyone. Just a reminder that the DEED meetings are all recorded and will be posted to the DEED website. Another reminder to silence your cell phones. We'll review and adopt the minutes. I do have just one item in the minutes to a quick correction on the last page. And this just might be a Scrivener's error. They refer to the CECL as a C-E-C-I-L. That would be a C-E-S-C-L. I believe that's right. C-E-S-C-L.
C-E-S-C-L.
Is that right? Okay. So just a quick correction there. If there isn't anything else, I'll entertain a motion.
I will make the motion that we accept the minutes as corrected.
Have a second?
Second.
Okay. So moved. Any discussion? None seen. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Abstentions? None seen. All right.
I'd like to get a text from the second traffic to be here in about 5 minutes.
Okay, very good. Thanks. We'll review the upcoming events. I don't see any.
This came in this morning,
okay.
So I'll go through it. It's the weekly calendar for the Board of Commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
On September 9th, on Tuesday at 10 a.m. Board of Commissioner hearing at the board hearing room at 5:30 on the same date, September 9th, CTRAN Board of Directors meeting at Vancouver Community Library, Columbia Room, 901 C Street, Vancouver. On Wednesday, September 10th, 2014, no meeting. No morning work session scheduled at 1:30 board time at Board Conference Room B. And on Saturday, September 13th, there is an annual Crow County Recovery Forum at Red Lion at the Key, 100 Columbia Street. And that's it. Life schedule.
Was there any calendar items for the Planning Commission? Do we know?
Your next meeting is the 18th.
Do you happen to know what's on that agenda, Gordy, at all?
I don't have to.
Talk about the open houses, kind of the scoping report summary. We had open houses the last 2 weeks about, I think, the ES alternatives, which really have changed.
Okay.
They're almost like we're talking about. A lot of things that we're doing. Rural industrial land bank application, what we're going to present. That's something you may all want to hear about at some point. So we're also presenting that rural industrial land bank to the board on the session on the 17th of September, 9:30.
Is that a workshop?
Yes. But I think your question, Mike, is about the next TC is going to be the 18W530.
Okay, very good. So the EIS alternatives that I believe we got an update on a month ago, it was on a couple of months ago, and that's just for the comp plan update, right?
Right.
All right, thank you. Any D member announcements? None seen. We'll move on to item two, the Shoreline Permit exemptions and updates, and Don will lead that.
As part of just kind of our list of items to discuss, this is one that kind of rose up to the top, and I was just going to cover some highlights, and specifically on the shoreline exemption part of the county's process. And this, I've had experience a little bit with the exemption process, both with the new shoreline program as well as the previous shoreline program. It's an area, kind of just globally, shoreline exemptions are probably treated differently in every community. Vancouver treats them differently than Clark County. And I think part of that is there's not necessarily one way to do this, but there's things that the state law and the shoreline program allows as an exemption outright. And probably the biggest ones that come up all the time are single-family residential lots, individual lots, and a single-family home being built on a single-family lot. And probably the next one that's most used frequently is repair and maintenance. And that could be anything from replacing a power pole that was hit by a car in a shoreline area, replacing that as a repair and maintenance, to repair and maintenance on a house or a commercial business. And those are, or it could be a dock. It could be, you know, repair and maintenance on docks. We've actually done those in other communities. I think what I was just going to kind of walk through and give a handout of the current code sections that talk about those exemptions, and there are other exemptions as well. And I think part of what I was just going to try to do is make a comparison between Vancouver's process and Clark County's process about how that's being treated. There's kind of a line about, in the Vancouver process, which is probably the minimalist process, there's an application form and there's no fee for a shoreline exemption. I just checked with John Wagner and confirmed that this morning. The county's process is a little more on the side of asking for quite a large amount of documentation to the point of possibly almost to the point of actually asking for a shoreline permit in terms of what the documentation is that's being requested. So there's a wide variety here between those. And I guess the question fundamentally just for discussion is, I mean, twofold. What is the appropriate level? I think there's also this, I think, situation where maybe shorelines needs to be treated as itself as an exemption activity and not bucketed with critical areas. Although critical areas are a separate component, they have their own kind of realm of processing and requirements. And I think essentially it really may not necessarily need to be bucketed with critical areas, and that's kind of how it's being dealt with at the county. So that was essentially just an opening comment. And the most recent experience we had was a client that came to us, and it turned out, you know, this kind of just became a revelation a little bit. It turned out that the shoreline permit was necessary for repair and maintenance for a site because they were actually adding, this is a power pole being replaced, but they were adding material adjacent to the road. They needed to widen it, and that was going further. They were still going in to the area next to a creek, and that legitimately requires a shoreline permit. But then I was thinking, well, what if it was just a replacement of a pole? What's involved with that? Well, many times you're going to get into a cost. By the time you go through the application process, the application process can far exceed the cost of the actual work. And even way back in time, I had a project at WSU, and this was way back in time, where we did an exemption on the secondary access road before it got built. It got washed out of the 96 flood. And even at that point, people were complaining and saying, well, I've got to do all this documentation. It's going to cost more to do that than the actual repair. So there's kind of this point about how far should, you know, how much information should there be. Obviously, there's a need for information. You need to know it's exempt. But does it need to have full-on engineering or design plans and a formalized process? Or could it be somewhat more informal like the city of Vancouver? So that essentially is kind of it for discussion purposes. So. And I know Eric was mentioning that, you know, he's had some experiences with residential situations and some challenges.
So the main discussion here are the differences in how two jurisdictions handle or review and process the shoreline exemption. One, it's an application form, no plans?
No plans, just an application form and no fee.
Okay, and is that taken, and it's rare that you'll ever have any shorelines review without the critical areas review too. So is this on a separate
That's really
track.
I totally think that's appropriate to look at it just in isolation, because I think you very well could trigger critical areas, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you throw that all into the mix.
Okay.
There's kind of a piece on that, making a distinction. This is a shoreline activity because it's done by the state law. It's done. If there's critical impacts, that needs to be addressed and mitigated for.
Okay. So the critical areas portion of that does not need to be reviewed with the shoreline's exemption. They can be two separate options.
It can be two separate options. Yeah. That's how Vancouver's.
Okay. And is that how the county handles it too, or do they want the review of the critical areas reviewed concurrently with the shoreline's review?
It appears to be the case that you just mentioned, that it's a combination together. It's all kind of, I mean, you may be separate forms,
right?
But that's
because that was, and then I think that any review of shoreline's critical areas, it makes sense to review them concurrently so that it's all done at once from a timing standpoint. But you have a certain amount of documentation that you need to provide for the critical areas, whether it be, you know, a mitigation plan or whatever it might be.
But not every shoreline permit is going to require a critical area permit. That is not true in every case.
And meaning that's probably more repair situation, because I know that if you're going to be building within a shorelines area and you're outside of the 100 feet from the ordinary high water mark, that's the shorelines area. But if you're outside of 100 feet of the ordinary high water mark, isn't that the limit for the exemption? I think
you still have to meet dimensional requirements. You have to meet the setback requirements.
Right.
So essentially, the box is if you build a residential house, there's a shoreline piece, which is you got to meet the setback.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be taller than 35 feet
unless
you do a visual analysis. Essentially, that's it. I mean, and then if you're going to do grading, you got to look at the other issues, but those are independent. Are you going to be in a floodplain? You need a floodplain permit, obviously, for that. Are you going to impact the wetland, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't necessarily throw you into a shoreline permit review process because you're doing those other activities. So in other words, you can have a shoreline exemption and still have a critical area permit for other things.
Right.
So I think it's more of a process about what do you need for statement of exemption. That's fundamentally what it comes down to.
Uh-huh.
Should you have to spend $700 and go through a formalized review process for statement of exemption or not? That's the fundamental question.
Okay. Does the city require an establishment or a survey of the ordinary high water mark in order to establish where the shoreline's buffer is?
I think you'd have to prove, again, dimensionally, that you're meeting requirements. So I think you'd have to provide some mapping of that to show it. I mean, I think you need to provide a case that you're not in those areas. So.
Okay. Don't let me be the only one that talks here. You guys can ask questions too.
So I think really kind of the gist of it is what information is there? What is needed to process that? And I guess that's, I'm not sure how often this comes up, but when it does come up, it's usually a situation where you're looking at this kind of like.
Is the city's review a type 1 or type 2?
I think they're just basically doing it as a type 1.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because
you're the county.
The city. Because my experience with the shoreline exemption in the county is we need to essentially provide the same mapping that we would for any other shoreline review. We need to establish where the ordinary high water mark is. That would then dictate where our 100-foot buffer is going to be for any construction to keep us out of doing a variance.
Yep.
We need to do cross-sections. And at the same time provide the other information that's required with regards to the habitat buffer, vegetation protection buffer, and all that.
And I think that there's probably two buckets. One is if you're going to build a house and it's in a critical area, you're going to be going to a fairly significant extent. And I really don't necessarily see an issue with having to do the documentation full on. But if you're simply trying to build a house or put an accessory structure on your property,
mm-hmm.
and you're way back from the shoreline,
mm-hmm.
and you're not impacting critical areas, and maybe that maybe that's really the gist of it.
Is this something, this kind of smells like what we did a while back with regards to the geotechnical work on single-family residences, particularly large lots, where we were able to have essentially a statement done by a geotechnical engineer indicating that there either are no steep slopes, and if there are, then there would be a recommendation for a setback from there, and as long as we show them on the plan, we don't have to go through that particular review. This sounds like something that might want to go in that direction. Is that sounding kind of like, I don't know if you were around when we went through that. I don't know. Just
yeah, it seems like the exemptions are almost going through a variance process. I mean, it's a type 2. It's saying shoreline exemption is a type 2 review.
Right.
Just to say that you don't have to do anything. For example, when you, if you read this, if you're going to do a test pit, technically you need to submit a type 2 application. Say if you
for septic?
Doing a test.
For septic testing?
Septic, for any preliminary work, you know, geotechnical work, anything like that. You're basically doing a exception request, a type 2 application. It's quite a bit. Normally, I'm guessing what's happening, students probably doing it.
Yeah.
They're probably what?
They don't even realize that that would take an exception because it seems like it's such a minor impact.
Right.
Typically, those are exempt from about everything.
So why the disparity in the interpretation of what needs to be done with the city versus the county?
I think there's the regulatory and the procedural interpretation of what is needed. I mean, no matter what, you're going to need to show that you're consistent with the generalized thematic elements of the shoreline program. Mm-hmm. You need to show that to get an exemption, and that's important. How you show that and what you have to provide to do that is discretionary. You could go as far as almost asking for a full-on shoreline substantial development permit to mm-hmm. get an exemption, or mm-hmm. you could simplify that process and say this is clearly outside of the shoreline jurisdiction, clearly outside of the setback requirement, clearly within the height restriction, and clearly exempt. And that's doesn't necessarily need to be something that is a real elaborate process.
Sure.
Kind of question, please.
Absolutely.
The permit is issued by whom? Environmental? This is an environmental permit. It's not
that
is our shop. It is your shop.
Okay. DOE would have the final say on the shoreline permit uh-huh. or variance, but on the exemptions
okay.
or reasonable use. But in this case, it is the county that essentially gives approval of the exemption.
I see.
Chuck or Marty, have you guys heard any grumblings about cost or process with regards to this?
Sure.
And
I'd like a side-by-side comparison between an application for the City of Vancouver mm-hmm. and Clark County. City of Vancouver's, a lot of the waterways are urbanized or urban. Clark County's are not urban and urbanized. So it's not very often that you're going to be doing something in the county and not impact something on critical areas, on our critical areas.
Right.
And we don't have urban waterfronts in Clark County.
And I agree, Marty. I think most of the time you're going to hit a critical area. I guess the question, does it need to be bundled with that, or can you simply say it's exempt?
Yeah, from the shoreline.
From a shoreline perspective, I mean, does it need to be bundled or not? I mean, I'm just trying to extract that, because it's kind of getting bought into that mix, it seems like.
What do you mean bundled with some underlying critical area requirements?
Right, yeah. I mean,
why would you unbundle that if we could run them concurrently?
Well, in the case where you end up only having the shoreline exemption, that would probably be the case where you would not, you know. I mean, obviously, if you're interested in doing a full-on development, that's great. If you're dealing with repair and maintenance thing that's only shorelines, it's a lot to go through to replace a power pole that's been hit by a car that needs to be replaced in shorelines. I mean, that's a lot to go through just for that, if that was the only thing that was involved. And it is a case-by-case basis.
Sure.
I do agree if there's critical areas involved, it should be probably the full boat. I mean, but again, I think the exemption piece, though, I think needs to be looked at, like, what is the driver here? Is it critical areas or is it the shoreline?
Right.
What are you asking for? What are we really... you shouldn't really necessarily be going through a shoreline analysis for something that's exempt. That's really kind of the fundamental issue.
And I would agree with that insofar as also providing the same amount and same level of detail on a plan that's required for normal shorelines.
Yes, exactly. And again, this may not, I mean, I had this, this has not come up a huge number of times, but I guess maybe the biggest issue is single family residential.
Yeah.
On individual lots. That probably is what's going to come up the most. And to be honest, our firm really doesn't do that many of those.
Right.
Typically involved in commercial or utility projects. And so that, but it just was like dawned on me like, wow, this is a pretty intense process to get an exemption.
I would say, just based on the example of a power pole, that you got a point. Statute says that any activity that takes place in shoreline jurisdiction has to
Any activity.
What the law
also says is exempt from a permit, but not exempt from the regulations.
So for the things that are exempt, they still have to comply with the program. That's the law. We can't change that. That's
right.
The statute. So the question is, for those things that are exempt, which is why John's bringing this to you, and it's a good discussion, how do you say, how do you show for something that's an exempt that is still complying with the program? What level of detail? And he's presented what looks to me like two bookends, and I'm guessing there's every jurisdiction is different. Is it a full-blown deal, you know, with engineering plans to say you're exempt? No, that's overkill. On the other hand, if we have to show at some point that for everything that's allowed as exempt is meeting the standard of, you know, net loss of shoreline ecological function, which is what we're after, it's probably a little more than just saying you don't need to do anything. So the question is, where do we jump into this? But the law says, if you're in shoreline jurisdiction, you comply with the program. Even if you're exempt, you have to show that you're complying with the program.
Right.
What you're exempt from is getting a shoreline substantial development permit, the cost of which, the threshold cost of which is $5,718, where they got that. I haven't even looked. So keep in mind that just because you're exempt doesn't mean you don't have to meet the requirements of the program. So now, what does that mean?
And I think it's a dimension. I agree with you, 40. It's obviously at a minimum of a dimensional requirement in the code. The question is what is it beyond that? I mean, that is the question of the day.
And if you're just replacing a pole and there's nothing else around you and it goes down and you've got to take it out, stick another one in, that's a good example.
And unfortunately, that's where we start looking at this. And maybe those are not the obvious examples. Maybe there's a lot of examples that this really works well. It kind of feels like, in some ways, maybe, like if you're in a rural setting, you probably would want to not do, maybe there should be, I guess it would be nice. I mean, I know there's a predetermination process for wetlands and habitat. And that may be another course here, is that maybe there's a shoreline version of this as well that says, and maybe that gets packaged into that. You do a predetermination and basically say, are you in, are you out? And, that's the first call, and maybe if there's an exemption process that maybe gets built into that or not. I guess what maybe, depending on how often this comes up, and again, I've only seen this a few times, maybe this is not a high radar screen, high priority item for the county. I don't want to make something that seems relatively low priority be the high priority, but it's probably those extreme examples that you see, and it's like, wow, this is a lot to do for, and the client's going, it's going to cost more to do the permit than it is to replace it.
Yeah,
and that's where it gets kind of crazy. So
don't disagree.
You're talking about the time and cost for the applicant typically using a consultant, those costs.
Construction costs and consultant costs together. Like if you're repairing a flood damaged roadway, we had a project and the client was irritated, it was like, hey, it's running to do an exemption. And that we had to document everything and basically that process took longer and was more expensive than the 30 cubic yards of fill that went in on the site.
So there isn't anything in the program that states how an exemption needs to be reviewed. It's up to the regulatory agency to decide how. Gary?
No, we have in our program, I'll read it to you. It says that the statement shall be in writing and shall indicate the specific exemption of this program that is being applied to the development and shall provide a summary of the shoreline administrator's analysis of the consistency of the project with this program and the act. The letter shall be sent to the applicant and maintained on the file in the offices of the shoreline administrator. that's in our code. So for anyone who wants exemption, that's the
law. Right, but it doesn't say in there you need to provide typical cross sections showing existing ground elevations, proposed ground elevations, heights of existing structures, heights of proposed structures. I'm sorry, that's the non-residential type 2 review. I think it's the same in both, as well as all the other information that is listed in here. That's Clark County has decided that this is what they want to see.
You still need to determine the order of high water mark in order to figure this out.
Right, okay. And that's what he was saying, is that there's a minimal amount of mapping that would most likely need to take place. But what we're saying is, if one were to look, for instance, and I'm just thinking off the cuff here, if we were to look at the base flood elevations on GIS for a piece of residential, rural residential property, say along the Washougal River, for instance, and we can look at Clark County GIS contours and see that it is clearly out of the floodplain and clearly 100 feet at least from the ordinary high water mark, through a predetermination process, would all of this then need to still be done? We still have critical areas to address. We understand that. But is there a way that we can save our clients five figures by just looking at it and saying, it's really obvious that this is not, that this is clearly an exemption?
Yeah, you look at the checklist. Do they require, does the state require a CEPA and a legal lot determination for an exemption? Is that like in the state statute?
I don't know.
Again,
It's for non-residential, it's for a shoreline exemption for non-residential use type 2 review. Yeah.
And that the predetermination might be a type 1.
There's a lot.
Yeah, and
so say you're doing a power pole. Do you use this application?
Yeah.
So you get a legal lot determination to relocate a power pole, put it back up. That seems that part there. It should just be NA. You should go to the box and check in. But I don't know if that's happening.
I think this is just another case of the one size fits all, and that's why we're here to kind of root these things out. And maybe some discussion needs to take place with staff and Don. Maybe what you ought to do is get a side-by-side comparison of what different jurisdictions in the area are doing with regards to exemptions, and just compare them and start the discussion and the conversation with staff to see if this is absolutely necessary or if there is another lower step process, kind of like the type 2A process for conditional use, that we would do this for an exemption when it's clear that you're far outside and clearly exempt.
Well, I think the idea of a predetermination process would work pretty well, because if you could look at it and, like you said, clearly determine that this is
staff can make a clear finding of fact that that's the case.
Yeah, and you know, all you got to do is be able to show that you meet the setbacks, you meet the height requirements, et cetera, et cetera. You're a clearly exempt by state statute use here.
Right.
So, if you got to get into the critical areas or some other permitting
process,
that's a different story.
Yep.
It's the shorelines, and I think the repair projects are probably the biggest, mm-hmm. or utility projects that are specifically exempted by state statute.
And all that can be confirmed at the time of building permits submittal based on where it's located on a plot plan, and that conforms with what the predetermination shows.
You know, one example maybe how this could be modeled for stormwater permits for rural single family, there's a little checklist that they require. And if you're under a certain number of square foot, you're basically exempt and you're done there. You turn the form and you're done, it's documented. It seems like something like this could be very similar, where you have the allowed exemptions and you check the box, and then it has a reference to the code and you meet those. So which one are you requesting? And why are you exempt? You have a short narrative, you know, whatever supporting information. Probably don't need a legal determination. Probably don't need a CEPA unless it's something more. And then there's a piece on there where the county staff can require more. I mean, there's a difference between an exemption to replace a power pole or to test it than to build a garage in the shoreline. So there could be a simpler form, mm-hmm. and it's still documented. I think you still meet the statute, but it much simpler process. And is that how the city's doing it, or is it?
Well, I mean, they're dealing with it differently. But there is an example in the county that we found quite successful, which is similar for floodplains.
Okay.
You can do a floodplain inquiry, which we found to be quite effective in determining these cases where there may not need to be a full-on floodplain permit. And so that's kind of where...
Or a significant amount of survey information that needs
exactly.
to be provided.
Exactly. So there's... That it's a lesser... That's worked well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is, you know, it's going to come up more and more. I think for the realtors out there, they're trying to market, you know, a piece of rural residential property. The shoreline exemption that I went through, I mean, we were right, you know, we were at or slightly above the 100-foot mark from the ordinary high water. It's understood that we would have to go through a certain process and so that we could show that, you know, we clearly are out of there. But I mean, it's those that are. It's a no-brainer. The no-brainer is kind of what we want to avoid having to go through this.
I think that the one size fits all may work in some applications, and so there's been a lot of work put into this, and I want to respect that. But I think if there's another bucket,
mm-hmm.
maybe there's more than one bucket, and that's the end discussion.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a way to do a smaller bucket for something that's in repair and maintenance.
Right.
Or single-family residential that you may not have critical areas, that would be useful so that you don't get thrown into a full-on shoreline exemption type 2 application form process.
Do you mind looking into some of the other jurisdictions and what they require?
I would suggest I can call Rebecca Schroeder. I know her pretty well.
Okay.
So.
And even if you were to get checklists or the code, and then. I don't know, is there peanut? What's that?
I do have an issue in this arena. I've got a code enforcement action pending against a client in this. They essentially cut down trees in the shoreline regulated area. To me, going through this process and the time and expense of having to document this, I think more dedication really is to address for the code enforcement. So to me, there's got to be some sort of de minimis standard there. Why are you forcing this video to go through a very expensive, time-consuming process when really the mitigation is going to be not that much and be less money?
So are you talking about an exemption or are you talking about a code enforcement situation?
Well, it's a code enforcement situation.
It's a code enforcement.
I think it's a bit of a misfire. An impact to repair an area of the shoreline is not de minimis. And so then to remedy it through a de minimis process is, I think, a little bit imbalanced.
I guess from my perspective, we have documented evidence that it's a situation where there was a hazard on the property. To me, that's an immediate harm situation that you're exempt from the Shorelines Act from taking those actions on your property. And if you have a code enforcement action that comes in on top of that saying you're not exempt or you have to demonstrate an exemption after the fact, then I do think that is an issue.
So you're kind of looking at another aspect of the exemption process, whereas hazard trees or vegetation, if documented by a professional, say an arborist, those would be exempt and can be removed. And that's, again, a part of kind of what you're talking about, lumping that as part of this.
It would address violation of a habitat code, though. If there would have been some prospective application to impact a repairing area in the habitat. So shoreline, okay, you might take care of a shoreline issue,
right,
you might have a habitat.
Yeah, area. And we're bifurcating those two items here.
I don't want to get them lumped together.
Yeah, we don't. We're trying to separate the shorelines from the critical areas here. Maybe that's something that if you have...
The specific code that was raised in this specific violation, and to me, obviously there's overlap between critical area ordinances and shoreline regulation. And I don't want to get too me there's got to be a simpler process, a situation where the owner goes out and does stuff which they think may be exempt or which can be later not be exempt because there's a hazard situation. And going through the process of getting an approval from the county after the fact of exemption costs more than actually doing the mitigation. We're not talking here these other exemptions where you're talking about building a structure or doing docks. Those are pretty weedy items, I think, compared to cutting trees.
Just looking at all trees up for the to get an exemption, $3,312.
If they all apply.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And see if it's really a big one.
And the one I'm focused on is the $700 plus or minus for a shoreline exemption. That's the part that is there a better way if that's in isolation. Yes, there probably should be a fee. I don't argue that, but should it be that much and should the process be as involved? That's the question.
But to me, it's not only a fee, but it's all the materials.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah, and that's what we've been discussing. Well, then maybe the best thing to do would be for Don to get to the others.
So I'll get some other examples. Right. I think, Jamie, I think that maybe some other jurisdictions up north of Puget Sound might have some. They have some abbreviated checklists we've seen on some application forms. I'm not sure if it's going to address the specific question you've got, but some of those are quantified down pretty finely, which is kind of what you're trying to get to, which is spending the money in mitigation versus an application process. That corrective measure, though, that's maybe a little bit of it's in that bucket, but it's kind of maybe I'm not sure how to deal with the corrective piece because that's something I wasn't really prepared to address, but the corrective action piece.
Yeah. The corrective action piece is seem to be a better use of the public time, public dollars, private dollars in a situation like that. If it's a de minimis situation, to conduct the plantings and make sure that there's maintenance there, rather than just spending money on processing consultants to go through an exercise.
Yeah.
And I guess that's my frustration.
I'll take it on this comparison. At least Vancouver, Clark County,
I'll talk. We'll want to see, I might suggest comparing apples to apples insofar as finding other jurisdictions that are rural in nature and have similar environments, shoreline environments. Marty brought up a very good point with regards to urban versus rural shorelines environments, and I think that we want to be as close to apples as possible. Also with regards to not only, the comparisons within the regulation, but submittal materials, fees, I'm talking woodland, there might be something, in Cowlitz County, fairly locally. I don't know if Longview Kelso have any rural areas or if they're all urban. I'm not familiar with those jurisdictions as much. and then maybe coming back, and in the meantime, maybe staff could noodle on this a little bit and see if there might be an opportunity for what we might consider something along the lines of a predetermination or an inquiry, something to cut out, And not only are the fees, the $3,000 in fees, but then you have the consultant that has to prepare all the documentation and at a minimum get the ordinary high watermark surveyed and put onto a plan of some kind that would be accepted by the jurisdiction too. So if that kind of sounds like what the next step would be in this regard, I think it makes sense to certainly investigate it further, and if it turns out that hey, everybody else is doing it, then okay. But if it turns out that they're able to meet the regulations, Gary, as you mentioned, a state regulation with something less than that, or if they happen to have a process that is where they look at it and say, yes, you do, or no, you don't, maybe that's what we take a look at too.
And I will, I'll look into that and report back.
And I think we have a pretty full agenda next month. If you can get onto it before that and just send it out to the DEEB members and staff, that'd be great. If not, maybe have it prepared, but I don't see it as being a hot, like you said, a hot topic item, but I think it's something we've got to need to keep
going. I don't want this to be, you know, the focus.
Right.
It's more of a, maybe perhaps an anomaly
sure.
in the code. But it, when you hit it, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a hammer.
Okay.
Question, Jim?
Yeah.
So there's a separate process for residential than there is for non-residential.
Yes.
I wonder how important that is, and is there...
Well, I don't know because they have
value in consolidating.
No, I think there's value in looking at something that we're not going to be looking at issuing a building permit or any other type of permit.
Mm-hmm.
Because to issue a building permit, you have to have a legal lot of record.
Mm-hmm. And so okay, and that makes sense.
We
that
run across
that's a different
costs that are not legally created.
Right.
We can't by law issue a permit.
Right.
So if you've got something that, and there's no permit that we will be issuing.
So and it kind of comes back on this. If you're going to go full boat on this thing, and you know you've got shorelines and critical areas, this probably works. You know, I mean, but if you're not trying, you're just trying to figure out, are you an exempt? Is there an exemption here? And you're going to.
My question isn't. I wish it was that complicated, but it's simply this: there's two separate properties, two separate forms:
residential
and non-residential.
The non-residential, we probably.
Why don't we just go to one form?
Yeah, they have the same exact submittal requirements.
Well, they're
and the same
fees.
The non-residential is slightly more expensive.
Yeah, I'm just suggesting maybe here's your process. If you track residential, here's a couple extra steps if you're non-residential. But there's two separate forms and they're worded differently. And
I think it goes back to the box, the check box that you're talking about.
Look into that, Don.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, we didn't have anything else to do. Oh, Gary.
I don't know what the fee is.
But
whatever changes that are suggested would be to go through a limited amendment process and get approved by ecology.
I'm sorry, limited what?
Limited amendment to our shoreline master program and get approved by ecology. So just as far as process goes. It wouldn't occur until these changes go into effect.
Right.
Sometime in the year.
So ecology then approves the jurisdiction's review process and all of the submittal requirements?
Well, so anytime we make a change to our shoreline master program, we actually have to do an amendment to it.
Okay.
So that amendment needs to be approved by ecology because our code is our master program.
Are these submittal requirements in code?
Yeah. Is this part of
no. It actually might be in the submittal.
Are these in that?
Yes. This is all in code.
Okay.
The handout?
Well, no, not the handout, but what Don is talking about is if we're talking about the exemption, I didn't see the handout, so I'm just letting you know. You know, if you're making any changes to the code.
No, there wouldn't necessarily be changes.
Yeah, it does work.
Right. Gary, I think we're not suggesting any changes to the exemption language,
okay.
But I think the critical question is, I think on processes and procedures, I don't think that this application form is codified in your process and procedures.
No.
So I don't think you need to do a limited amendment based on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All the code
says? We'll consult with our attorney. What do you require leaving on?
Wow, that's a nice can of worms you opened up, Don. Well done. You keep everybody busy for a while. But it's no big deal.
I've got plenty of time.
Okay, were there any other comments regarding this?
Yeah.
None seen. Well, thank you, Don.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
You're talking like November? Is that what you're...
Yeah, I think that would be fine.
I need a little time to, like, do this.
No, absolutely. Yeah, let's say November for right now. And that'll give staff enough time to, you know, kind of...
Okay. We can recircle back.
Perfect. Thank you. Next up, Marty and Jamie on the residential impact fee delays. Kind of a follow-up on what their presentation was, I believe, last month.
Take it away, James.
Yeah, so one of the tasks I was tasked with is to go back to the building community and get specific how far down the process we would like to delay the impact fees. The guidance that I got from our builder members as well as our board was to push it to closing if possible. I know that triggers some problems in terms of, you know, how, again, we're trying to secure this. To that end, I've reached out to Noah Blanton has Stuart Tidal, as well as John Saber, who's the president of Community Financial Bank, which is doing a lot of the lending and the building and shopping right now.
Which bank?
Community Financial.
Thank you.
And
subsidiary of Banner Bank.
The subsidiary of Banner Bank. And John's a pretty savvy person in the industry, and so my hope is to have a carry with and participate in a sit down and figure out how we can structure something that works for the building community but also satisfies what the county is going to care and make sure that there's enough security and cost of dimensional processing. So to that end, I think we would like to have that meeting and come back next month. So hopefully in between then, give some information to Marty and his staff that you want.
I think the practicality side of it too is not just, it's trying to create something that not only works for the county and for the builders, but realistically too, have the foresight to include the lenders and tile companies that they can buy tile insurance on and how they can make sure that they are aware of it. How is that, you know, is it different processes and ways, and Noah had some ideas online, and Stuart had some ideas on that, and then for John Satterberg on his side, on the financial side, if they're in first position or second position on this, is there an actual value that then is perceived by the bank in that regard, or do they not, and is it not even an endeavor that's worth value? So, because the real benefit to the builder more so is not the interest savings on the impact fees, as it is if you can in a way subordinate, in a way if the bank can take that equity value of those impact fees and reduce that loan amount. It reduces the cash amount the builder has to bring in for a spec loan. That's where the real value is to the builder. But if the bank's going to still look at that in the same manner, that, well, this is a risk, this is something that we have to pay no matter what, there may not be a perceived equity that's then received by the bank in that regard. So that's, to me, a big question. And so if we're just talking about an interest savings on the amount of the impact fees, and then you have fees associated that are tacked onto the county for doing this whole process, it's an endeavor that's not worthwhile.
Right.
So that's why it's important to bring all those groups together to figure it out.
Okay. So it sounds to me like not only does the county and building industry need to get together, but it's the county, the building industry, title companies, banks, lenders, builders, everybody kind of needs to chime in and say, hey, is this really worth it? If there's a way to delay it and just delay it, that's one thing. If there's a way to delay it, but it's going to cost interest or there's going to be a fee associated here, then
it's not
worth it. Okay. No, that'd be great. We do have a full agenda on for October, but I think that we could squeeze you in as long as,
In October or November?
October.
Will you have all those meetings done by then?
Yeah, I think we'll have, instead of any conversations with John, I'm just because of the Labor Day holiday, trying to get that coordinated. I think we'll have those done here next month, and we'll be with Marty then. I think maybe, if anything, it'd just be another brief update in October, but maybe with a more formal.
In November. Okay. Or a determination as to whether or not you continue discussing this or we're just throwing it in the towel.
Well, it doesn't make sense.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Anything else on that?
Well, not everybody will get a loan, right? A bank.
Right.
So there's still value.
That's good.
Some folks. And it would be neat if there was a process that would either or kind of thing. Here's a process if you can follow it. If not, here's the standard. Go pull your permit and off you go, like it's always been.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, the concern that I heard last time from Dean and the county was that the interest savings versus then having to pay a fee to go record the insurance back and forth sort of neutralize each other. So how do we do it in a way to give assurances to everybody that these things will get paid and done and not cost a lot more from the process
handling.
Yep. Or staff.
Yeah.
Which then increases fees, which then gets you back to where you were at the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Number four, odd.
Yeah.
I haven't heard from you for a while.
Like forever. In the 4 years I've been here.
Indeed.
So, Harry, thank you for volunteering me. Chuck, I want the professionals are going to come up. I'm going to make a short introduction. Chuck and Jim and Marty have been instrumental in this. And I think we have some handouts.
Everybody's got one.
Everybody has one.
It's in the back of the
agenda. Yeah, it's attached to your agenda.
Yeah, to the minutes.
Oh, okay.
The last page.
Very good. We got it.
Oh, great. So,
yes.
The task was to review opportunities within the county building department, combine certain permits, that would be plumbing, electrical, mechanical, for example, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
That was the task. So, Marty Snell was instrumental in establishing a work group comprising Permit Services Manager Chuck Kreider, Chief Building Official Jim Muir, and also Susan Davidson, who is the Department Information Systems Coordinator. Those folks were from Clark County, and then I had a site superintendent named Kevin Phillips join us. He does a lot of the application process for us, and myself. So after we spent a good afternoon, a couple hours working through some of these topics, and I'm going to turn it over to the professionals now and let Chuck walk us through this here a little bit. Any errors in this is something that I put together. Any errors in here are mine, and so Chuck and Jim and Marty.
I'll be sure to look really close.
Well, thank you, Odd. Thank you, Dean, for having us to talk to you guys a little bit about what's going on in the county and what we're doing to help the community. It was nice to get together to kind of look at what we could do differently, what we are doing differently. And I think from that meeting, we really found there's a lot of things we're doing right now that are great and are benefits that we're realizing you guys have no clue we're doing it. How much does our community know we're doing? Odd had a lot of aha moments of the things that are going on right now. I definitely don't want to be one that steals the thunder because a lot of it really is coming from the building department and Jim's team. And so if Jim doesn't mind, I want to talk about just, obviously we've done the lean process. We're well into our first full year of that, heading into the second year now. Lots of successes from that. I think most of our builders are pretty well informed of what the expectations are up front. We're consistently meeting the 11 to 13 day turnaround time to get those permits out. We've developed additional programs when there's sales pendings, potential losses of sales, and even 13 days is time critical. We've come up with programs that help them get a permit out in 3 days. But we really have some requirements tied to that, so you can't just come and say, I want it in 3 days anyway. Or pay this extra fee. You've got to show us you have something you're going to lose because of that. So that, again, we're showing that we're trying to help you and make sure you're not losing the sale and that your revenues are still what you want them to be with your clients. That's what I have from our side of the World of the Permit Center. A lot of what we administer in the Permit Center really does come from the House of the Building Department. So I'd like to turn it over to Jim at this point.
And then kind of going backwards, because as I understood, one of the original questions was, do we have combined permits? And so if you go to the, you go about two-thirds down the page, it says SFR permits currently include. Mm-hmm. So currently we have combo permits for residential that include building, plumbing, mechanical, irrigation, and windows and deck, of course, if it's in the submittal. We don't do electrical in the county, so we can't combine that. I should say we can't. It's possible someday to make some kind of link between us and L&I.
Do you farm that out then?
No,
it's all the labor and
industry. Oh, I see.
That's a state statute.
Right. So which permits are L&I?
Electrical inspection in the county.
Oh, county.
City's allowed to do it. County's not.
Yeah, really? Mm-hmm. The reason is because they couldn't provide the services to the areas that, and they didn't have the county-wide areas, they would have such a meager income, they wouldn't be able to
provide all the services. So the county can ask for an electrical program and maybe grant it, but they really try to bunch a geographic area together. Something maybe we could look at in the future, at least to maybe make it, maybe we can make it link up better with our process. Currently, it works fairly well. The next part going down on that kind of that same thought is it possible that we could do commercial and multifamily under kind of a combo permit? And it could be in some, we talked a little bit about it in our meeting, it could be in some instances if it's a given. So like an apartment building, for instance, is not much different than a house. So we have a pretty good idea on average it's going to have 1.5 to 2 baths, it's going to have a kitchen, and it's going to have this kind of set amount of these plumbing, mechanical, and other related permits that could be combined. On a hospital, it probably wouldn't work because we've got so many. So that's kind of the range of, yeah, on some end of it, maybe we could consider a combo permit that would cover some of those items for, say, apartments, condos, things like that, perhaps, where it's a little bit more contained and we can get a reasonable average. And the whole thing is based on some kind of reasonable average. So when we do a combo single-family residential permit, we know across there we're going to have some one-bath places and we're going to have some five-bath places, but most people are going to be 2 to 2.5 baths. And so it's the amount of services is kind of based on that average service levels. So any kind of questions before we move on to
that part? Yeah, I'm just going to add that the conversation meeting went off strict task for a fair bit. That's why there's these other items are not right in here. Right.
I wanted to stay kind of on the original task question.
Well,
and so we'd be really glad to hear if you have any thoughts relative to, hey, why wouldn't a combo work on, or maybe a semi-combo work on a particular type of commercial permit? There gets to be a balancing point about if we have 50 different kinds of combo permits, at what point, you know, that might be so many different versions of combo permits that we now bog down the whole system. But perhaps, a number that's like, hey, there could be 5 kind of areas where we need. And then just to, then the other part of it is some of the things that we currently have, and I know we're just going to kind of touch on them today and then come back with more details of our bigger presentation. But we do currently have, like Chuck talked about, we have the lien process, and then we have kind of a section of what we labeled smart permitting, where we put together the limited trade, which is a book of 10 for push-pull HVAC and plumbing kind of installations, hot water heaters, furnaces, pumps, etc. And a similar one is RSW, that's a roofing, siding, and window, where you can buy a book of 10 and get those inspected. Saves the contractor 9 trips down to the permit center and makes it easier for them out in the field relative to the inspection process. They're a little different, each of them, but and I can answer some more questions about them, but I'll get through the list and see how much time we have. Then we have a pro remodel permit, which is for smaller remodel projects, a bathroom where we have a professional doing the work, therefore we're not going to go and look at a 3x4 piece of sheetrock to see if it was correctly nailed. We're going to go with the fact that it's a professional. We think he can nail a 3x4 piece of sheetrock. Then we have the fresh start process. What that is to try to help non-conforming commercial tenants get legal, if you will. So get a fresh start on either the landlord, the tenant, or both didn't realize that they should have had a certificate of occupancy. So we put together a program that if
in a building, they will let us inspect them, get them up to a basic fire life safety level, and then our requirement is that as you go forward, Mr. Landlord, you'll make sure folks come in and get their tenant improvement, and we'll go from there. So it's, lack of a better word, better description, is kind of a get legal for certificates of occupancy. And then we worked with the Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce on the next one, which was to bust out the term tenant improvement, which meant different things to different industries, from realtors to bankers to building people to developers, and we identified specific tenant improvement types and adjusted the services and the fees relative to whether it's just a change of business, just a name change only, so it went from Frank's Pizza to Bob's Pizza. And then there's change of occupancy, and there's three or four in between those to kind of break them apart and make them a little bit more accessible, and the fees more specific to that level of service. And then I think Marty had talked to you about, we have a new virtual video inspection program that's called SureLook, and we have an alternate hours inspection program. TikTok. We also have a couple of other. We have a minor repair permit, which allows somebody to make a small repair to a truss rather than get a full-blown permit limited to an area. Then we have a simple structures permit, which identifies accessory buildings that are under 750 square feet. There's a few other ones, but anyway, that's kind of a rundown of the things that we've put in place and continue to try to innovate other ones up to the point that they make reasonable sense. Always open for suggestions.
I was putting it the same as, and that was in a subdivision with a building less similar. And I can't remember, there is no such thing as same as. The foundation is always a little different. But the structure itself, a lot of times, is more similar. So the structure review, is there a similar to?
It went from same as, which is, it's supposed to be the same as the last one, to nearly similar to, somewhat right. Similar to, well, you could say they were related by blood, but it's more likely by marriage. It just went. And the time that staff spent identifying the versions of it. So if you were just going to change out, if you're just going to change out a little bit of gingerbread, no problem. But we've got right, left, upside down. Oh, we just want to add a rec room. We're just adding a bedroom. We're just doing this. We're just doing that. And they were the same as, just kept drifting. We pulled it back in and we said, absolutely this. And then it drifted again. So it was just like every time we did, it was drift. And the reality was, it was tied to a 5-day plan review turnaround. So in the days that we had these, it was in the heyday of construction. It was the 5 days that was inviting. It wasn't the same as part. The customer didn't hear same as. They heard 5 days, and 5 days was 5 days. So we've substituted same as with me. Not that we would have listened to it, but I can tell you it's really an accountable nightmare. Everybody has their own version of similar.
Sure. Yeah.
That's really kind of basic.
I'll just add, I was really impressed with the progressive nature that our county community development department, in this case, the building department has. I was not aware of all these things. They were some kind of aha moments. So thank you guys for first participating. Marty, thank you for setting that up. But for the, I think that down at the bottom, if you look down at the bottom, I think really for me, the future lies when Marty's able to trade out the operating system. And there'll be some real opportunities there to take a generational step in how we process permits, how you review permits, and even maybe inspections.
So I'll just piggyback it a little bit. At some point, I'm not sure if it's going to be October or November, I would like to have a 10-minute opportunity to kind of give Deeb an update on where we're at with replacing Tide Mark. The kind of sneak peek is that we had issued an RFP and had a number of vendors submit proposals. We were down to two a year ago. We did some site visits and we did some further work following the site visits, and we weren't going to get anything radically more enhanced. We were going to get incremental improvements. So late last year we canceled the RFP. We kind of refocused where we really want to see some improvements into the 21st century. We reissued a second RFP and had submittals due, I think, April. So we've been looking at other vendors, and one's kind of percolated to the top. We've done some more work with them. We've had them on site they did an on-site demo. We had like 12 web demos. We had them on site for a couple days to look at how we would create our case hierarchy, how we would map data over from the existing system into a new system. So we're kind of getting closer and closer. We have a two-day, maybe three-day scoping session in a couple weeks that will generate a statement of work that we'll negotiate with them, and my hope is that we have something under contract by the end of the year. But again, until we have this scoping session in a couple of weeks, and then again meeting with them, I won't be able to tell you if we execute a contract with this vendor, we'd start the work probably January 10th. I just say the 10th because it sounds good. Well, we want to get through the holiday season.
Yeah.
I want to be after the first of the week. But it's going to be an 18 to 24 month implementation period. Vancouver went through their migration of Tidemark to Hansen, and it was a couple years. Depending on how quickly we move through negotiating the statement of work, that's when I'll try to tee it up for a D meeting. Could be October, it could be November.
Yeah, we'll put you down November. November right now.
Okay.
We got a full October, yeah. and since Jamie wants to talk more in October.
So the vendor lead that we're looking at, head and shoulders better than the top two of the first RFP. Okay. So that's kind of the long story.
That concludes the presentation.
Perfect. Thank you. I had one follow-up question on single family or I guess building plan review is, are you guys considering or can you consider electronic plans review?
That's within the system.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, that's one of the key features that we want. And strangely enough, when I look at other agencies,
mm-hmm.
do they have an outward-facing electronic plan review, submittal process and review, and markup and return?
Mm-hmm.
Not many agencies.
Hmm.
I know Hillsborough is doing it. They also had Intel pay for some of that, which is,
any chance we can get some
nice, benefactor, right?
Right.
So Vancouver, my understanding is they've gone to a system where it's not outward facing. Maybe they're using some of their utility engineering folks to plan electronic plan review.
I don't know. They're not from my experience. They're not using any electronic plan review.
So it's we want. The system go live, we want everything that we have today working well and working better.
Right.
Electronic plan review might be the first kind of rollout post go live.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
And just kind of parenthetically to that, how has that been going from the engineering side with regards to the, do you guys miss having that big plan set in front of you, or is it okay to review it from a electronic standpoint.
Yeah, we just have one person who still likes the big plan, but most
is that
of
you?
Us, no. But most of us like the electronic plan review. It helps us out, and we don't have to scan everything. We send it back electronically.
Right.
And actually, most of the consultants are doing it now. And I heard, good comments from most of the consultants going back and forth.
Good.
Yeah, and we do probably close to 70% now.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Our building plan reviews are 70. We have the big, 27 or 30-inch monitors are big.
Yeah.
And they're the, set side by side, so we're ready.
Good. Good to hear.
Sounds good.
Alrighty. Next up, and we are right on time.
Thank you.
Next up will be Chuck, I would assume, since I don't see Susan here, about the Permit Center wait and service times.
Yes.
Oh, goody, data.
You bet. So what I did, we use a program called QFlow, which is our queuing system. When you first come into the Permit Center, you are greeted by the front desk, and based on what your need is, they give you a ticket. It goes into the queue and is called by our permit tech. What I did is, because I wanted to give you real data, so what I did was I randomly pulled some dates out of the last 60 days. This is from hour by hour, the tickets that were issued, the time they were issued, their wait time, and their service time. Most of the program gives you averages. This is one of the few that gives you real time at that moment. So a couple of things that I wanted to go over with you as you look at the data is, first of all, you may, even on the first page, about halfway down, at the 10 o'clock hour, you'll see that in a period of 3 seconds, we issue 3 C tickets. Uh-huh. Those are called counter tickets. What that is that's the identifier for us, that that's a person that came in with 3 lien reviews. So those are 3 residential permits in a subdivision. The way we allot our time for those is the staff takes 20 minutes to review it, and then 10 minutes to sit out with the customer if there are any issues that it needs to be returned to them. Otherwise, it's set in the queue to go over to a permit tech to actually take in. So a person came in that day with 3 of them. You have their wait time while they were sitting in the lobby, and then the service time as well. In most cases, they're able to sit in the lobby the entire time, all the way up until we take their sheet out to them to say, here, we've taken it in, here are the fees due at application. So one of the biggest data numbers that you'll see, where there may be an hour wait, hour and a half wait consistently, maybe as you're looking through this and you see the C tickets. Because what the data doesn't show is that when they were done with the lien review, they were transferred into what we call the B ticket queue, so that the staff knows it's going to take it in. It's a building permit application that's ready to go. So when they call that number, when they take that number on the next in queue, they're going to know that that's a building permit they're taking in. In most cases, you're going to see that our wait times, along with service times, do fall usually 45 minutes or less. We do have times where they get higher than that. I'm going to go over that with you as well. But the data also reflects our first in, first out queue. What that means is our staff is set up that as soon as they close a case, it calls their next number for them on an auto, kind of an auto dialer type system. So this doesn't take into account appointments at all. If a person's made an appointment, that is a completely separate queue, because we would not want a counter person to come call an appointment. We have people set each day that handle the appointments during the day. It also doesn't take into account engineering, because they have a separate queue that is theirs. If you see an H ticket in here, it is a day where we don't have environmental services in the permit center due to their staffing levels. We get them generally Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 to noon. So if you see an H ticket on those days, it is a day that we didn't have them available. Otherwise, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, they would not show up in here either, because they wouldn't be in the queue during those times.
What is H ticket?
Habitat.
Habitat.
Yeah.
The other part that we're trying to use a little bit is we have a planner of the day. If that planner of the day happens to be at lunch or they're in a pre-application conference or something like that, the L ticket becomes something the permit tech tries to take care of for the land use planners. Also, if an L ticket comes in and they have questions but it's actually an application, that L ticket gets transferred over for the permit tech to take in that application because our planners are not trained to take in the application in the current time mark system. So keep that in mind as well. A couple of caveats I do want to share with you as far as the data. Keep in mind, I pulled July and August. Again, random dates. We are in a high development season, coupled with a high vacation season as well. Summertime, a lot of my staff have kids that are were heading off to college this year or off on their summer break as well. Another thing that kind of increases some of our wait times is how we've shifted the experience for customers and kind of the expectation. If they give us the quality up front and we get the quality up front, yes, it takes more time, but the outcome is much better for the customers as well. So it does skew our numbers because our staff spends a lot more time with customers now.
The overall cycle time is shorter.
Correct.
Up front is longer. Overall cycle time is shorter.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's not just on the residential side. We're trying it with land use. We're trying it on all the different sides. As far as, yes, they're not only in process, but if we can get all your data up front more often, you're going to have an ultimately, hopefully, a better outcome because all the data is there. Your project's not constantly put on hold. So one of the things that we're coaching the staff to do is help the customers out. If there's data that we have available for them that normally we would have just said, here, you need to go get this and then come back. Get it for them. Give that to the customer. Make that available to them now so we're not sending them away. Even though, yes, in the past, it's been the protocol to just send the customer away, we're trying to shift from that and not have that be what we do constantly. The other part that can impact it is you look at, and I kind of noticed some of the things, is you look from about the 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock hour, the wait times do have a drastic increase again because I'm challenged with lunches, especially when people are on vacation, things like that as well. I am not going to trigger foot. We do have days, and we've had days recently where a customer can wait an hour to an hour and a half, and then even their service time could be a half hour to another hour. I can't remember the day, but when I looked, I was like, God, I wish I could go back and figure out what that was. There's one in here where the customer waited an hour and 45 minutes, but then their service time was an hour as well. And it was a queue ticket, which means it's questions. So was it a homeowner that had the questions? Was it suddenly the permit tech got this and they understand wetlands and all the habitat stuff, so they went through this long drawn-out conversation because it's a queue ticket that was issued for their questions. So you'll see that in here as well. A couple of things that we are doing to try and help this is we've hired two new employees, and unfortunately it's not like a Fred Meyer cashier where you can sit them in a room for a few days, show them how to use a scanner and a check stand or a register, and away they go. It is really an in-depth training process. The two we've hired are at the level now where they understand the get them in, get them out really quickly. So like we have an R ticket, it's called the ready ticket. If you've been notified that your permit's ready and you come in with your permit number, you get an R ticket. You in some cases are in and out in no later than 10 to 15 minutes or no longer than 10 to 15 minutes. I have that staff that can pull those immediately. One of them has been trained to X tickets, which is our express. Usually those are generalized. They're like your mechanical, your plumbing permits that are coming in. They're ready to take them in.
And Chuck, sorry to interrupt, but with the R tickets, then the people at the counter know to issue the R ticket?
Correct. Okay. In the training of the front staff, if you came in and you said, I was notified my permit's ready, they're going to ask, do you know your permit number? If you say yes, they're going to give you the R ticket.
Gotcha.
You know,
okay.
You know your permit number. We hope you come with an email, and that's what they try to do when they email that it's ready. They say, bring this email with you.
Right.
Because what it allows them to do is when they come to get that R ticket, that customer, they can stop off, grab that, and away they go. If you don't know your permit number, what we've done is we've left that as an express ticket because there's an extra step now we have to take. The other one that we have in training right now, the second employee, is now she's shadowing, so I've taken her off of helping those quick R's, the X's, because now I have her shadowing each of the staff members for a week, going over the in-depth, what are the conversations that we're having? When someone walks in with a random question, I have a, as Jim, our building official, used to say, I have a lot number and a dream. What can I do?
That's a parcel there.
Parcel number and a dream.
Right.
She's learning that. What does that look like? How do I start that conversation? And so it changes, and she's been with us now for 6.5 months. And we're to a point with her comfort level, because you don't want to obviously flood them with everything. So she's at the comfort level where we're moving her into learning more of the stuff. And we're in the first, we're in the fourth week of that now, of shadowing, coach weekly to it, and things like that. Another thing that we've done, when we started our remodel, we really started encouraging appointments, and we have not stopped that. I keep coaching my staff up front. I hope they do it when you guys are coming in. If our wait times are half an hour, I'm coaching them to tell you, the wait time is half an hour. Would you rather make an appointment and come back? I may be able to get you in this afternoon, or I'll get you in tomorrow. Because our goal is to at least try to do a same-day appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have to minimize impact on the walk-in, but even by next day, we're trying to make sure we do appointments.
Who communicates that message, Chuck? You come in, you grab your ticket, and then you wait 10 minutes before you hear the, hey, please go back to make an appointment if you don't want to wait 30 minutes?
Or is it the counter first?
Or is it the counter?
It should be at the very front counter.
Right, so as you walk
before
in,
you get
you walk in, before you ever get a ticket, if they see the queue is holding in 30 minutes, I'm asking them to make sure they're starting to start telling customers, hey, you know why.
Wonderful.
So, and there's a lot of teaching with them as well, because, and if you have 10X tickets, and you're sitting in a 30-minute wait, and that's all that's in there, that potentially may not be a continued 30-minute wait.
Mm-hmm.
You could suddenly have three people open up, and your exit is clear out in 20 minutes. So it's tough to gauge, and so it's teaching them how to gauge that and really give the customer an educated response on, should you do an appointment?
Mm-hmm.
Would it be better to come back?
There's always a potential for...
It could be better than it is right now.
Right.
Or... You could have 20-minute waits, and suddenly it turns into a one-hour wait because
give them the option.
Two tickets in the back end up being hour and a half conversations.
We check your internet online, and that's really helpful. That wait time.
That displays real time.
And I was going to ask, is there any correlation you're seeing on peak hour? Maybe if it says it's an hour and a half wait or an hour wait, are you still seeing a whole bunch of people coming in?
I don't think people realize they go to the website.
Which I didn't.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. I don't think people
do you ever sign up there? Give away the secret.
No, we're not going to do that.
They might get me down to 20 minutes.
Right.
I don't know about it either.
How's the search of the website solve the wait time as we go permit stuff? And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it is great. I don't think our customers know about it as well as we'd like them to. And it is hit and miss. I tell you what, I thought, honestly, Tuesday was going to be drastically busy. I kind of did it all hands on deck. And I think we had three people in the lobby at any one time. But then yesterday, we hit an hour and 45 minutes.
Do the wait times online, are those per ticket, or is that just a general overall
wait time? Average wait time.
Average wait time for that.
Because keep in mind, most of our queues are first in, first out anyway.
Sure.
So if it tells you it's an hour wait online, it's probably an hour wait sitting here.
Okay.
No matter what ticket, unless you are an appointment and things like that.
Right.
So,
hey, Chuck, what are your goals for service time? Have you established some, or what do you want to do with that?
About the time I think I've established them, they blow up.
They still remain goals and targets, right?
Correct. My ultimate goal for a customer, when they come in, each ticket is so different. But my ultimate goal is when they're sitting in the lobby waiting to be called by a permit tech, I don't want them to have waited out there more than 45 minutes. I really don't.
That seems like a long time.
I'm hoping you're going to say 15.
That's what I thought.
Here's why that's I would have thought that as well, except it becomes unrealistic. If I said my X tickets, absolutely. My R tickets, my goal would be 10 minutes. A Q ticket, based on timing though, again, if you look in here, I had a Q that was held for an hour and a half, and they waited for an hour. They're actually being serviced by a permit tech for an hour and a half. So
what are your constraints, John, to deliver faster service? Obviously, more staff, right?
Well,
equals money, equals budget.
Correct. And we have the two that are in training right now. But the other part is we don't want to ramp up all these people to get those wait times down to, let's say, half an hour or 15 minutes. But it's not sustained. Mm-hmm. Like the development out there is not sustained to hold that, and the revenue is being generated. So we're looking at, okay, get these two trained, let's see what this looks like.
Okay.
And then, because...
Well, I don't mean to be fussy about it.
No, you're fine.
Why not? Why not ramp it up and ramp it down? And forgive me, I know you have your own challenges, but in private industry, that's what we do too.
Correct.
You ramp it up to meet the need, and then you got to ramp it down when the need evaporates.
Keep in mind, though, in like your world, you can go and get contractors. You can get people who know how to do framing.
Yeah.
And they know how to start.
Right.
When I go to hire a permit tech,
right,
I don't have a person who knows how to be a permit tech.
There's a training process, I understand.
So in some cases, even to get the basic foundation of being a permit tech, to even take an R ticket, can take 30 to 45 days just to get them to be able to take an R ticket.
Take the 30 to 45 days. So let's compromise. It's not 15 minutes. It's not 45. Your goal is 20 minutes. Right in the middle.
Maybe you can look at different. Wait. Let me get my calculator here. Okay.
45.
I'm sorry.
You could look at different wait times depending on the ticket
times. Correct. And that's why I say I have different goals for each type of ticket, but if I have to do an average across the board of my tickets, I would have to say it's
one for the average. We all understand the average ticket thing, but to the guy or gal walking in the front door, you know, hand me a ticket and how long do I have to wait? Well, geez, too bad you didn't come in with an X ticket. I could have had you serviced in 10 minutes. They don't get that.
If we push more appointments
out to
and then free up that capacity in the wait area.
See, we can easily do 8 to 16 appointments a day. And in some cases, more people make more appointments, we can handle more. But I schedule for 8 to 16. On average, right now, we're getting 5 a day.
5 appointments a day.
Yeah. And we have customers, I would probably say at least 3 days a week when we offer them a same-day appointment for the afternoon, they take us up on it and come back. Mm-hmm.
So let me jump in and add a little perspective. Jim heard this last week. I have friends around the state. We get together with some of the other large counties. We get together every 3 or 4 months. Snohomish County, regular business, they only do it by appointment. So they only have so much permit counter time for drop-ins.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that they've done is through a consortium of Puget Sound cities and counties.
MyBuildingPermit.com.
They drive all of their subcontract, you know, HVAC, all that stuff, to the website, and they're applying online, paying online. Their permit center manager says that they probably save 30% of their counter visits through that website. So, you know, if in a couple of years from now we have a new system, and a lot of this permit activity, for the simple stuff, is coming through the web page or the, you know, a portal, then we won't have those people coming into the permit center, and we'll free up capacity for, you know, for that.
Right.
That
was
one of my questions. Chart was doing this
huge.
Do you have a sense of those a lot of mom and pop type folks that are coming in, or are they literally just consultants that have questions with the difficult issue? In most cases under the queue, I would say 60% of them are probably mom and pop, or
they come in with like their kids trying to do something. The other part of that, I would say probably, yeah, 60% would do that. 30% is probably out of town consultants and contractors coming in, learning and understanding our process. And here's the thing, especially with the holiday, we've gotten a lot more out of town stuff that have come in. And remember, my staff is helping them now. Instead of giving them everything back and saying, here, you gotta go get this, I'm having my staff help them. So, am I creating a detriment by doing that? Because we do the same for the other 10% that are the ones who know Clark County. They know how to do everything when they're working with their clients here in the county when they come in. So those don't require a lot of things. They may have a one-off question because the land has something unique about it. But the same applies there. I want my staff to make sure if they need to give you something, they're giving it to you instead of sending you off to find it yourself.
Right.
About the only thing we ever send someone away for is a GIS packet. And I've even, in some cases, said, let's take it in and tell them they need to go get it for us because we usually get it in 48 hours. So, I mean, I think some of that may be trade-offs to what the customer service experience is at the moment you're in there.
Mm-hmm.
Trades off what those wait times look like.
Were you done with your presentation? You got a lot of questions in there. I don't know if you were done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Well, this is certainly encouraging. To the point that it looks like there's room for improvement, but and it looks like that improvement might take place once Tide Mark is replaced. And that in the meantime, it sounds to me like, I mean, getting the word out about the wait times on the website is great. You might consider having something as you walk in that says the average wait time is 1 hour, 15 minutes. And they might just go,
turn around
and walk out. You hate to, and maybe it's a combination of the hours, 1 hour, 15 minutes at the same time, or you can make an appointment. We would be happy to make an appointment with you later in the day, if possible, tomorrow, whatever that is. My experience with the one application I had, that I sat there for an hour-ish or whatever, if I had walked in and seen that,
you made an appointment.
I would have made an appointment or walked, or turned around and walked right out and come back maybe later on.
Yep.
Because I didn't know what the wait time was. Because
yep.
There weren't a lot of people in the lobby.
Yeah.
But it still took a long time to get seen. And it was a very simple application.
Yeah.
One that could have been done online. You know, it's an addressing application.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I will tell you this, not to interrupt you. I was out last week out of town. But when I first started, I would probably say within 3 weeks of starting, I believe in the 5-minute rule. You open your doors 5 minutes early and you close them 5 minutes late.
Hmm.
Everyone's clock is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So in working with our security downstairs, they allow customers to come through, drive to wait. We're averaging, when we open now, in the last few weeks, we've averaged 5 people at the moment we unlock our doors. Already, and that's how our days are starting. Right?
Sure.
So, and not to say that remains consistent over the day, but a lot of times people say, well, when's a good time to come in? And we tell them, you know, usually the 8 to 10 hours really a sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want to come in. We've talked about, I know in the past they have it, they had like a 7 a.m. time for contractors and developers to come in that was specifically for them.
Mm-hmm.
All that could come in during that time.
Mm-hmm.
But from my understanding, and not to say just because it didn't work then, it doesn't work now, but a lot of people didn't take advantage of that time, and so
speaking from experience, even if we're ready to go, we're not going to be submitting at 7 a.m. I mean, flat out, I'd make an appointment and know that I can get in and just sit there for maybe 10 minutes.
Correct.
And get in then, because, you know.
Keep in mind, we look at those things that have happened in the past, because I'm not opposed to something that, even if I implemented it, failed last time.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean we can't tweak it and be successful.
Right.
Game for anything. So.
Well, I would certainly encourage you to look at showing the average wait times there at the permit center, and then really getting the word out about that there's that opportunity to make an appointment. If it's later that day, can the permit, can the counter people make that appointment, or they can't?
Make that appointment later.
Oh, okay, good. So they don't have to get you.
You're the, honestly, and I say this being funny, because when people call me, I'm like, you know what, just call me. I can make the appointment for you.
Right.
There's a full appointment number and email as well.
It's, yeah, I just like emailing and chat. That's all it is.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that. That's what I'm there for.
Okay.
I'm capable of helping to make that happen. But yeah, there's a card they usually try to give to customers as well.
Okay, good.
It has that phone number as well as the appointment line. Just to throw him under the bus since he's here, engineering has an appointment line too.
Yeah.
Yes. So, and it makes it easy for them, because what we've done in our partnership with them is they don't sit in the permit center
right.
The
entire
time. Not anymore. Right.
But
right.
If you've made an appointment, you come into the permit center, they come down.
Oh, okay.
They help you right there.
Good.
Right.
So, and I guess what it comes down to is getting the word out to the general public that they have those options available to them.
Right.
How you do that, I don't know, but you know, I didn't know about the online wait. Clock, and you know, I work here. So
no. You can pay me later.
Yeah, thank you, Don. I'll take out the good. Well, that's encouraging, and I guess what we can do right now is look forward to what the changes are going to be once the new system is online. Continue to work, you know, train your staff and let them know. And it's good to hear that you're being proactive with regards to not shipping people off because they don't have one little piece. It is encouraging to hear that if it's not counter complete because of one little item that can be easily picked up and returned the next day, that you're not going to ship them out, have them wait another hour potentially to then resubmit.
Yeah.
I've been through that. It's frustrating, and it's a little embarrassing from a consultant standpoint too. But when you're the mom and the pop or the son or daughter that you're helping out your parents, and they don't have anything, yeah, helping them out as much as possible, I think, is what Clark County needs to continue to do. Good. Thank you. Any other comments for Chuck?
Yeah. I haven't set foot in the building department in close to a year. So do you have, I mean, some of the things that you had on here with what I put together with you guys was, do you have something that's just a one page with just a real brief description of, you know, your different permit options? You know, there's the Sherlock. I know you have your little thing that I saw that's great on Sherlock and the TikTok, but is there just a one-page thing that just, and not only about the setting appointments and the appointment line number, and the, if there was a one-page piece, I'm just thinking like for the realtors, okay? So if I had a copy of that and I said, hey, then I could have a membership meeting and distribute it out to our members, or for BIA and they have the dinner function or whatever, they have a one page, or and it's like go visit if you want greater detail,
yeah,
go to the GIS site,
link to a website.
Yeah, you know, if there's that on the educate, to me it seems a big issue is just the education side. And if you just have a one pager
services,
that would be, I think, and you coordinate with some of the different, like BIA, CCAR, not CCAR so much, but BIA, that's going to, CCAR a little bit, because they're going to let the general public know, that's going to help on that side.
Well, and one of the,
this is great what you guys are doing, appreciate it.
Yeah, no, you have a great idea. We have some ideas in mind. If you're ever in the permit center, we have a pretty large front wall. And one of the things that we do want to do with that is, and working with Jim, come up with kind of an advertising wall that advertises the services we provide that aren't just a big stack wall of permit applications.
Mm-hmm.
It's the stuff we do that makes it better for our customers. So, and then looking at doing, I'm a fan of tri-folded covers because it's a piece of paper, people are always weak.
Right.
But putting something together like that with the stuff is pretty good.
A takeaway helps them because then they can keep it and then they can refer to remind themselves, okay, go here, I can do this, that can
we get printed on the back of the Starbucks car.
There you go.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. Much appreciated.
You.
Yeah, absolutely. It's time for public comment, but I know that Jamie, did you want to discuss anything today further?
Yeah, two things. I apologize for being late. I think everybody in the state of Washington was trying to get home to watch the Seahawks play. Two things. I had sent a PowerPoint over, and I'm still sort of tweaking it on the population side, and I'm hoping maybe to bring that back as a comment more than anything to the group next month. I'll be participating in a panel next Thursday Committee on Buildable Land Supply. And I was one of the eight folks that was asked to testify. This is on behalf of the Realtors Association. And the main concern there is the lack of building inventory for residential construction right now, and what are some solutions we can use that. But it's sort of coupled with the GMA updates right now.
Population forecasts.
I already presented a letter to this board on population projections as far as I view it from a historical perspective, and went back and looked at the data from 1960 through 2010, and it does suggest that during that period we ran about a 3% growth rate, and yet our current projections from OFM are 1.12. So if we took a longer view than what OFM is projecting based on that, it still seems very, very low to me. So it'll be interesting to see.
What's OFM?
Pardon me?
OFM?
Office of Fiscal Management. Okay. They're the ones that set the growth rates that the counties are obligated to consider. That'll be one of the topics of discussion with the Senate next week. So I would like to give a report, I guess, more formally on that next month.
Okay.
As far as just sort of an awareness thing. The other item I had, just briefly, I'd like to mention that Steve Schulte's retirement party was yesterday. I showed up at it. It was very well attended, and I know that Steve's done a lot of work with Deep over the years, and I've worked with a lot of us in the room, and I just would like to acknowledge that. It's really sad to see another great county employee right off into the sunset, but we'd like to acknowledge that from a Deep perspective.
I would concur. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll make note of that in the meeting in the minutes for next month. And you're right. That's a big shoes to fill, and a hole that's going to be open. And I don't know. It's like, how long was he in that position?
20 years.
20 years with the county, 15 as transportation manager.
Wow.
Yeah, I wrote him an email after I got back to the office yesterday, and it was very heartfelt, but thinking back to a lot of the projects that we worked on over the years together, and he really was a good public servant. I told him not just for the county, but I mean the county as a community, he really was lost.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be, Carolyn's got some big shoes to fill, and I'm sure that she will fill them, but
yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for mentioning him. You're right. It goes without saying that Steve was one of the best ones that have been around here, and hopefully that'll continue. You know, hopefully we'll get someone just as good at a minimum. Anything else from anybody else? Public comment? None. Oh, yes.
Yes. Just to make sure we stay here for the full time. I just want to remind folks that the municipal stormwater permit, the general permit that we're covered under, is out for public comment right now for some modifications that were made to incorporate the Pollution Control Appearance Board ruling. So I would encourage people to take a look at the permit and look at some of those changes. There's a hearing in Vancouver, a workshop and hearing, so Ecology will present the changes, and then there will be a hearing for testimony September 24th at 1 o'clock. In Vancouver. Ecology has that on their website. I can't remember where it's at, whether it's the library or the Water Resource Education Center, but I would encourage folks to attend that hearing. And also, if you have issues, if you want to talk about it, you could give us a call, either Rod Swanson or me, to kind of hear what we're looking at in terms of comments, and we can incorporate your stuff. We've already done that with a few people already. We've had some conversations with Peter Tuck, who has some issues with the Western Washington hydrology model that people have to use now to default, which is part of the permit mod. So it's a really good opportunity for people to comment to Department of Ecology about having to use a model that doesn't work down here. But we've got some good comments from Peter. And so just using that as an example, if you want to give us a call and talk about some stuff, we'll be happy to give you some ideas and appropriate as well. But, it'll be good to attend that workshop on the 24th.
Very good. Thanks, Rob. Anything else? We're adjourned.
Thank you. Appreciate it. You bet.